When Brian Williams is talking Watergate, John Stewart stops covering for you, and even tax cheat Charlie Rangel won't stick up for you, things are not looking good at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
So why hasn't it affected the president's approval ratings? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. A cell phone video of Toronto's mayor allegedly smoking crack has dominated Canadian news this week, but only three journalists have actually seen it.
Then, you know, about 90 seconds in, the phone rings. He looks right at the camera and says, "That better not be on," and then it shuts off.
Plus, a group of Catholic priests and nuns are blowing the whistle on sexual abuse in the church. One of the founding members is a very determined Brooklyn nun.
I'm just sick of waiting.
Impatient?
Oh, very impatient, yes. But I mean, I've been waiting for 20 years.
All that and more on this week's On the Media.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
I've never seen anything like this in my 18 years covering tornadoes here in Oklahoma City. This is, without question, the most horrific.
Okay, Lance. For a little while, the Oklahoma tornado sucked the oxygen from the firestorm of coverage of what's been portrayed as the three-headed scandal monster that's plaguing the White House. That's the impact of devastating weather, at once mysterious and straightforward, personal and public. It commands coverage, and the media can do a good job just by showing up. Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon.
I want to say thank you so very much to the media. The media has done a superb job over the last couple of days of keeping people informed.
But the monster roared back. The IRS scandal centers on a feckless, unsupervised, overworked office in Cleveland tasked with assessing a group's nonprofit status. That office targeted Tea Party groups with intrusive questionnaires and long delays. The IRS chief, later fired, said that the profiling wasn't political. Keywords were used to shortcut the process. And it turns out some liberal groups with progress in their names were mistreated, too. But egg still splashed copiously over the face of the IRS and the president. Here's Fox News' Andrea Tentaros.
When Brian Williams is talking Watergate, John Stewart stops covering for you, and even tax cheat Charlie Rangel won't stick up for you, things are not looking good at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
True, Democrats and the media have embraced the IRS story, but conservative legislators and commentators have really put pedal to the metal in pressing the charge that the administration lied, or worse, in connection with last September's attack on the diplomatic mission in Benghazi. The most extreme view holds that the president ignored warnings that could have saved four American lives because it was election season and he'd have to admit al-Qaeda was still a threat. That's the take of retired Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters.
This Obama administration, this case, was cowardly, duplicitous, and they sacrificed American lives for politics.
Fox News showcased that view, as well as the claim that soon after the attacks, the White House edited out of its talking points all references to al-Qaeda. Some objected to the president not calling it terrorism. He did call it an act of terror, but apparently that's not the same thing. On such minutiae, this scandal has revolved. But it didn't get much traction until ABC reporter Jonathan Carl leapt in with an exclusive report about the government's talking points.
I have obtained 12 different versions of those talking points that shows that they were dramatically edited by the administration. Take a look at two of them. On the left, a draft initially written by the CIA. On the right, one that was used by the White House, the final version. What was taken out? All references to al-Qaeda and all references to CIA warnings before the attack about the terror threat in Benghazi.
Even more important than those 12 versions was Carl's proof that they had been rewritten by the White House, proof supplied by an email about the talking points by White House aide Ben Rhodes. Carl quotes the smoking sentence, which read, "We must make sure that the talking points reflect all agency equities, including those of the State Department." The implication being that the White House itself intervened to shape the narrative for political advantage.
I think you can't overstate the importance of Giancarlo's report.
Alex Seitzwald is Salon's political reporter.
That report catapulted to the top of the news cycle. It became the biggest issue in Congress. The White House was rocked back on its heels. They held a series of deep background calls with reporters to try to spin the narrative again, and it forced them to eventually release the entire 100 pages of emails the next week, which they had said for weeks and weeks and months they were not going to do. So this was a really explosive report, and it turned out to be wrong.
Turned out, Carl only had a summary of the Rhodes email leaked by a Republican staffer, not the email itself. The actual email didn't mention the State Department or even talking points. All Rhodes, the White House guy, wrote was, quote, "We need to resolve this in a way that respects all relevant entities, particularly the investigation."
That one email was what showed that the White House was being political, was being nefarious, was trying to massage the narrative. And once you remove that, the entire story falls apart.
Whether Carl's source made a mistake or intended mischief, we'll never know. But the ensuing brouhaha spurred Carl to send a statement to CNN's Howie Kurtz. Why him? We'll never know. But he read it.
"I regret the email was quoted incorrectly, and I regret that it's become a distraction from the story, which still entirely stands. I should have been clearer about the attribution."
By which Carl means he and his network shouldn't have lied about it, which provides a sort of segue to scandal number three, the threat to journalism. First, the Justice Department, investigating a leak, obtained the phone records of the Associated Press, and then in another probe, got phone records for Fox News and its reporter, James Rosen. In the course of getting the information it sought, the investigators labeled him an aider and abettor and or co-conspirator in an espionage case involving an intelligence leak on North Korea's nuclear program. Court documents filed in the prosecution of Rosen's alleged State Department source included what appear to be at least five Fox News phone numbers and Rosen's parents' number in Staten Island. This is the scandal that most seems to outrage journalists. Here's Cokie Roberts with Joe Scarborough on MSNBC's Morning Joe.
This reporter being prosecuted for what?
Apparently for what?
Apparently for receiving stolen information, like he's a fence or something. Stolen property.
This is Daniel Ellsberg. He's basically being
prosecuted for, if he is prosecuted, for doing his job. This is something that has unified Democrats and Republicans and MSNBC and Fox.
The Justice Department denied it tracked Rosen's parents' calls and says it doesn't plan to prosecute Rosen. It has acknowledged reading Rosen's emails. The president said Thursday that the Justice Department will review its policy for investigating media leaks so that journalists are not at legal risk for doing their jobs. But all this sent a chill through news outlets, reporters, and sources, and in the long run, that's not good for the public. Like it cares.
Well, I mean, Washington scandals don't attract a lot of interest for the most part.
Carol Daugherty of the Pew Research Center, which conducted a poll between May 16th and 19th, found that only about a quarter of respondents were closely following the Benghazi and IRS scandals, and only 16% cared about the DOJ subpoenas of AP phone records. The wall-to-wall coverage of the affair between President Bill Clinton and intern Monica Lewinsky and the ensuing impeachment inspired much more interest, but also contempt. According to Gallup, three-quarters of the public said that the coverage was way overblown.
I mean, in fact, Clinton's approval rating went up famously through the impeachment scandal. And it was one reason why, the Republicans themselves were accused of overreaching on it. But in this case, so far, and the emphasis is on so far, there's been no apparent effect on Obama's job approval rating.
The public cares about the economy. Even during those polling days in May, when economic news was scarce, it beat the scandals. And the perception is the economy is getting a little better.
One of the reasons that Obama has avoided scandal for so long, at least by the terms I use in my research, is the economy's been so bad that there's been very little incentive for Republicans to push scandal allegations. But as the economy's improved, that incentive has changed.
That's Dartmouth political science professor Brendan Nyhan, back in 2012. He defines scandal as, quote, a socially constructed event in which the pundit class decides that a public figure has acted in a manner that contravenes established moral, political, or procedural norms. In other words, a news anchor calls something a scandal without quotes. A newspaper puts it in a headline, and it's a scandal because we say it is. Of course, some scandals are real. They're huge. They're news. Not every scandal is made up. The content matters, but
what I am saying is that on the margin, the political and media context in which an allegation is made can make the difference between a controversy fizzling and going onto the front page.
In the meantime, as current scandals lose their new car smell, the people who write and the people who speak, especially on MSNBC, are nominating their own.
There is a real scandal this week. We learned that for the second time in 2 weeks, a military member who was specifically tasked with preventing sexual assault in the military had himself been charged with sexual assault.
Any organization with the name of a political party in its title, from the Democratic Party to the Tea Party to the Socialist Workers Party, every single such application should have been rejected for 501c4 status as a matter of law. The real scandal here is not that those applications were delayed, but that they were ever approved.
You've got to hand it to the Republicans. In a week when they've obsessed over scandals, they've managed to miss an actual scandal. That's their 37th vote to repeal the president's health care law.
But the right is in on it, too. The real scandal, suggested Chuck Bentley in The Washington Post, is unbridled government spending, which he dubbed profligate. The real scandal, wrote the Weekly Standard's Bill Kristol, is the Obama administration, which, quote, degrades popular self-government and embraces American decline. The real scandal, wrote Washington Times columnist Jeffrey Kuhner, is the president himself, quote, a political thug masquerading as a progressive reformer. Hey, try it yourself. It's fun. No, it isn't. The real scandal, of course, is that on Capitol Hill, scandal-mongering masquerades as righteousness and marinates us all in muck. Coming up, talking about whistleblowing on pedophile priests with a Dominican sister who's fought church stonewalling for decades. Have you ever thought of leaving the church?
The church, no, the church is mine. They should leave.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting the Future of Nursing Campaign for Action in 50 states. At rwjf.org, the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence, at thescanfoundation.org, and the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. As I mentioned, the Oklahoma tornado did put a stop to the scandal blitz, but only briefly. Blogger Andrew Tyndall of the Tyndall Report found that the tornado filled 91% of the 3 network evening news holes on Monday, and all of them on Tuesday. But by Wednesday, tornado coverage dropped to just a third and scandal crept back in. We've brought back Brendan Nyhan, our scandal coverage scholar, to explain why. He says the problem is that tornadoes come suddenly, wreak destruction locally, and then pass quickly, while hurricanes, say in the Atlantic Basin, allow for a predictably exciting narrative. You know it, the gathering storm, the warnings and preparations, the widespread damage, and then the aftermath, the congratulations or blame. No tornado, he says, could have torn up a media landscape that at this moment is so fertile for scandal.
The conditions are ripe for scandal, right now. We know that second-term presidents are more vulnerable to scandal. Obama had very few scandals in his first term, so there's a bit of a pent-up demand for scandal on the part of both the media and the opposition. And two factors that I've identified in my research are present. The opposition party base does not like Obama at all, and we know that the legislators in Congress are going to be responsive to that in pursuing scandal allegations. And there are very few competing news stories. So these scandals got off the ground before the tornado because Obama's legislative agenda is stalled and there aren't very many interesting political stories going on right now. So scandal filled that news vacuum. The convergence of those three stories was especially powerful in jumpstarting the scandal conversation.
Right, and the media seemed to enjoy combining the three scandals into a great big one, crafting, as you recently wrote in the Columbia Journalism Review, an Obama narrative. You mentioned hurricane narratives. We love narratives. What's the Obama narrative?
Well, what's funny is that the media can't even agree on what the narrative is.
That's a good sign.
The media and the Republicans who are pushing scandal have been trying out different stories. On the one hand, people have argued that these reflect Obama's overweening influence and politicization of government, and on the other hand, his incompetence and lack of management skills. In either case, people are struggling to fit these into one template, and I think it's quite an awkward fit. The AP records dispute is more of a policy dispute than anything else. The IRS allegations have not been closely linked to Obama, although the questions continue about who knew what when. And then finally, the Benghazi case, it's not clear how much misconduct was involved. Bureaucracies edit talking points all the time.
Right. What about the outrage that seems to be evinced over things that are either non-existent or frankly laughable? Asking Marines to hold an umbrella over himself and the Turkish prime minister so they didn't get drenched.
When a feeding frenzy takes place and scandal is on everyone's mind, seemingly innocuous events and gestures can become swept up. What was amazing was the Washington Post wrote a whole story about the umbrella controversy. And it was a story because Obama was being criticized for it. That made it news. And the news agenda is set in part by what prominent opposition elites are saying. And the Republicans were able to drive even the umbrella controversy into the headlines. A great example of this is when George H.W. Bush went to a supermarket and was portrayed as being out of touch because he reportedly didn't know how a supermarket checkout scanner worked. In fact, it was some sort of special scanner that was a new technology of some kind. But as it moved through the echo chamber, it was turned into a tidbit revealing the supposedly out-of-touch nature of Bush, who was seen as a patrician.
And it's always the signs of elitism that gets picked up in these little ways.
We're very sensitive to political leaders losing touch with the people they're supposed to represent. And one of the narratives that can be powerful during a scandal is an out-of-touch president embattled, alone, in the White House, haughty, resentful. You know, the media loves to write that story. And it becomes a way to keep the narrative moving during a second term when typically there isn't that much going on Capitol Hill.
In my lifetime, I can remember that narrative for everybody, except maybe Ronald Reagan, who wasn't depicted as haughty, just confused.
Reagan had his own special second-term narrative, but it is a recurring theme, and we should expect to see the media reenacting those second-term narratives over the next 3 years.
Brendan, thank you very much.
Thanks again for having me.
Political scientist Brendan Nyhan is an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. A truism, or it ought to be, that the darkest secrets are harbored in the most entrenched, most opaque institutions. For at least a dozen years, the Catholic Church has been rocked by revelations of child sexual abuse by priests. The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops has since signed on to something called the Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People, and every year since 2004, U.S. bishops have done an internal audit of the number of abuse cases. This year, the number of allegations and victims they found dropped to a new low. A new group isn't finding that heartening. Calling themselves Catholic whistleblowers, they're priests and nuns, most of whom have themselves blown the whistle on sexual abuse within the church, some for decades. It started out as a kind of support group to temper the isolation they felt. But this week, they moved into public activism. Sister Sally Butler is one of the founding whistleblowers, so I went to where she's been working and practicing her faith for 45 years, a housing project in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. Butler's order, the Dominican Sisters, were given the option of wearing the habit or not, and she never has. She said it would have proved a barrier where she works. She's a stunningly vigorous 82 years old, doesn't look it, even though she gets around in a motorized wheelchair.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So you found your way.
I started by asking when she got on the path to whistleblowing, and she started at the beginning.
1968. In this neighborhood, there were riots and a great deal of disturbance. But anyway, we were very excited to come. And we worked as a pastoral team with three priests who were located in the church across the street in the heart of the housing projects. We became very good friends with the priests. We thought it was an ideal situation. In the course of a few years in the 60s and 70s, I met a woman named Ramona who was quite ill and asked me if anything happened to her, if I could take her little boy, Carlos. His mother died, I believe, in 75, and I did take him and I put him in the rectory. And he became officially a foster child of one of the priests, but he was mine. And that's the way it's been ever since. And I'm so lucky to have him. Fast forward to 1993, I was walking in the projects and saw a woman's apartment. I hadn't seen her in a while, so I dropped in. And she told me that Carlos and her two little boys and many others had been sexually molested by all three priests. It was impossible, we thought, but we found it to be all too true.
So you didn't find out about this until 20 years after you basically were his guardian.
That's right. We still were hoping and believing naively that if we brought this to the bishop, who was then Bishop Daly, that he would take care of it. I was sure that the men would be removed.
They were still there.
They were still in Brooklyn. So from 93 to 95, we tried to get to see Bishop Daly, but we never did. I've never met him to this day. We did see his chancellor, I think he's called, Otto Garcia. And we discovered that he and his lawyers were not at all alarmed or surprised.
They asked about the statute of limitations.
All they cared about, the dates. And that was a shock to us. We couldn't believe it. We went back again with that woman, Frances, who's the mother of the two little boys, because she wanted to have her say. And she screamed at Garcia in Spanish about her two little ones, because one of them, Jerry, in trying to stop the abuse when he was a little boy, he tried to start a fire in the church. The priest swept down on him and his brother and put them in Lincoln Hall, which was like a reform school, and she never got her kids back.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible. That's the power. The suffering was unbelievable. After 95, we really were stymied until 2002, when everything blew up in Boston. And there was an awfully good article by Dan Wakin in the Times. So I just wrote him a letter. I think he found it hard to believe, but he did follow up. And he had many interviews with us, but he finally did publish an article in March of 2002. So I guess that's when we all, including Carlos, became whistleblowers.
How's Carlos?
Thank you for asking. We speak every night. He's in the position now that he's sort of watching out for me. He's 52. I run everything past him before I do anything. And when this came up, I realized he was a little bit frightened, because anything like this stirs up flashbacks and panic attacks. It's as if he's a child again being molested again. He's right back in it.
Did he ever attempt suicide?
Many times, yes. There were several around 2002 because the repressed memories came back and he couldn't handle, he didn't know what was happening to him. His wife didn't know. It doesn't go away. It doesn't. And the bishops would like to dismiss the whole thing by saying they provided therapy. Well, Carlos has a good therapist. That'll have to be lifelong. And with good therapy and with medication, it's still awful. He'll go for days without sleep. Sometimes agoraphobia takes over and he can't go out of the house, so he can't hold a job. So they're living in real poverty, but they're very happy.
He doesn't have kids.
Oh, yes. They're married 30 years. He married an extraordinary woman. Not a Catholic, fortunately, so she just thinks they're all cuckoo. She's very down to earth. She handles the job, but instead of complaining, she brags because she has a house to go home to that her husband has kept clean. He's cooked. He's got the kids doing their homework. She's very proud of him, as I am.
What does it mean to be a whistleblower in the church?
I think it means standing up to power, no matter what the consequences. In my case, there haven't been terribly bad consequences, just a kind of isolation from some sisters. In the case of priests in active duty, it's really hard because they can be transferred or they won't be able to say Mass or administer the sacraments, which is the heart of what they do. So I think they're the real heroes in this. These men have been at it inside the institution much longer than I've never been really inside. Women aren't on the inside, but they were.
What's the system of accountability that is currently in place?
Well, on paper, there is a charter to protect the children that you're probably aware of from 2002. But from what I'm picking up, it isn't observed, or it is observed according to the bishop's whim. They don't seem to answer to anyone but the Pope.
And what do you know of this new Pope?
I'm reserving my opinion. I like what I see about his concern for the poor, of course. But I want his first priority to be this terrible horror against children. And I don't see that yet.
Have you ever thought of leaving the church?
The church? No, the church is mine. They should leave.
Are you feeling more hopeful now? It sounds like people are taking notice.
I am, yeah, particularly this past week. Other members of this group are not as hopeful. I noticed that at the press conference, Tom Doyle, the first whistleblower in the 80s, he worked for the Vatican and he was strictly church all the way and discovered this mess in Louisiana in about 1981 and thought it was a local problem and realized it was the horror that it is. And he's been fighting ever since and mostly alone. He does not have that much hope for change within the church.
Why not?
He has seen so much lying that he almost expects lying. He hasn't seen courage or honor or anything that shows concern for the children, and neither have I. I'm overwhelmed at how callous these people are. But anyway, I am hopeful because I've been getting emails by the dozen from ordinary people saying thank you or wishing us well. So I think maybe it's time for some more whistleblowers. For instance, there are many women who work in rectories or have worked in rectories, and they have been witness to crimes against children. But because they were maybe the sole support of their family, they couldn't take a chance on losing their jobs. And there would be reprisals. So what we want is a whistleblower protection policy. And, you know, this is where the press comes in, all of you in the media, because if you shine a light on this, then they're not so quick to fire people.
What happened to those three priests that in the 70s did what they did to the boys in your parish?
One of them died of AIDS. And this woman, Frances, one of her sons, has AIDS. The second one died, we're not sure how. And the third one is living the life of ease in Florida.
Boca?
Yep. Yes. Yes, a very nice life, a pension and health care, none of which Carlos has. And he's the one I want to I want to see justice someday.
You said that you really bumped up hard against the statute of limitations Absolutely. When you first raised the issue in connection with Carlos.
Yes.
Is that still a problem?
Oh, yes, because I think it's as many as 8 years we've been trying to change that situation in our state, in New York. And our main opponents are the New York bishops, along with the insurance companies. And the bishops spending a great deal of the people's money on fighting us on this.
What are you seeking?
A year of a window of opportunity when people like Carlos can come forward with their claims.
The year to come forward or starting that process, no matter how many years after the abuse took place?
Yes, yes. And that's what we're all hoping for. But that means here in the projects, it's going to be a real hard push to find the people who've been abused and then to get them to come forward. Because they're facing two monolithic entities. The Catholic Church, which is a white institution, and the people in the projects are not. And the second thing is the criminal justice system, which they don't want to get involved in. So I'm not happy with it, but it's the best we can do. I'm not even sure that we can get that through, but we're working hard on it.
So what is next for your whistleblower group? How do you plan to proceed?
I get a little anxious because I tend to want to organize this because these emails are coming in and they're terrible cases that have to be handled. So I don't want to lose anything or have anybody slip through the cracks, and neither does anyone else. But we're going to have a conference call again tomorrow, and I think what's going to happen is slowly we'll organize. I can see this growing the way SNAP grew. SNAP is the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. And they have, I guess you'd call them locals, all over the country and now all over the world.
The difference is that this can stop things perhaps while they're happening rather than come in afterwards.
And I guess that's why it appeals to me, because it's proactive and I'm just sick of waiting. That's why I like these people.
Impatient?
Oh, very impatient, yes. But I mean, I've been waiting for 20 years.
Thank you so much.
Well, you've been very easy to talk to.
Sister Sally Butler is a founding member of Catholic Whistleblowers, and we spoke to her in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. Coming up, scandal coverage Canadian style. Also, we boldly go again into a world where no one has gone before. Actually, I've been there a lot. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Late last week, Gawker published a post that achieved something Gawker posts rarely do. Upend Canadian politics. Gawker's John Cook alleged that he'd seen a video of Toronto Mayor Rob Ford smoking crack. Cook didn't actually have the video. His tipster wanted more money than Gawker was willing to pay. So instead, Gawker posted a long write-up of the video and started a fundraising effort it's calling Crack Starter to raise the $200,000 needed to buy the video, allegedly being shopped around by some Somali men involved in the drug trade. It's been the lead story in the Canadian press for the past week, but so far the mayor has dismissed the charge and slammed the Toronto Star for pursuing it. Here's a clip of that.
These allegations are ridiculous. It's another story with respect to the Toronto Star going after me.
The Toronto Star's Robin Doolittle says she's seen the video.
It's about 90 seconds long. My colleague Kevin Donovan and I watched it on an iPhone. It's a man that we believe is Mayor Rob Ford. It's crystal clear. It's well lit. He's sitting in sunshine, probably about 5 or 7 feet away from the camera, sitting on a chair, body turned toward the camera. He's kind of rolling around on the chair. His arms are kind of waving a little bit. He seems extremely impaired, mumbling, rambling, incoherent. In one hand, he's holding a glass tube with what looks like black resin on the top. We believe it is a crack pipe. On the other hand, we learn he's holding a lighter. At one point, he lights the lighter and cooks the pipe from underneath and inhales it and exhales a thin smoke. He also, in the video, can clearly be heard calling the Liberal leader, Justin Trudeau, a fag, which has also enraged a lot of people. then, you know, about 90 seconds in, the phone rings or a phone nearby rings. He looks right at the camera and says, that better not be on. And then it shuts off.
Do we know when this might have been recorded?
Our sources say it was filmed sometime in the last 6 months or so. The fact that he called Justin Trudeau a fag dates it a bit because Justin Trudeau just ran for the Liberal leadership. And that was just in the last couple of months. So you reasonably wouldn't be having a conversation about Justin Trudeau in this kind of setting 2 years ago or something.
So Rob Ford has been a larger-than-life Teflon Don kind of character in Canadian politics. Could you sketch him out for American listeners?
A lot of people compare him to Chris Christie, kind of that outspoken right-wing, kind of populist, bigger guy, every man's dude. And he's had a lot of controversies in his tenure. He was a city councillor. As a counselor, he often kind of stuck his foot in his mouth. He had a famous incident at a Maple Leafs game where he kind of launched into a drunken tirade at a couple from outside of Toronto and then denied it until confronted with proof and then issued an apology.
How did his relationship with alcohol set off the mess that he seems to be in right now?
2 months ago, I, along with a colleague of mine, Kevin Donovan, wrote a story about his longstanding battle with alcohol. He was asked to leave a military gala because a number of people felt he was impaired. And that kind of spurred this larger thing about his history with alcohol, which the mayor has denied, just for the record. But once the story ran, we started getting calls. And then this individual contacted me claiming to have a video of the mayor of Toronto smoking crack cocaine.
He has survived a lot of other scandals, large and small. This scandal, however, seems to have legs, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, I've been covering this mayor for 3 years. I've never seen the media go after him so hard. Typically, a Star investigation brings something to light, and he says, oh, this is just the Toronto Star out to get me, and everyone kind of runs with this, oh, it's the Star and the mayor at it again. This time, everyone is really holding him to account, and he so far hasn't offered any sort of substantive statement about this.
It is interesting because the kind of aggressiveness that you're talking about, and I watched some of the footage on your site, is relatively mild by American standards.
Mayor Ford, do you smoke crack?
Even when he was heckled by some protesters at a public meeting sometime back and they were marched from the room, they were just sort of expressing skepticism from their seats. I mean, nothing like what we see here. And I just wonder, do your press and politicians have a different relationship of accountability because of that niceness?
Absolutely. Canada has absolutely atrocious accountability laws. And I think a lot of Americans don't realize how great they have it. I know a lot of people complain about, you know, infringement on privacy. But in Canada, like for City Halls, a story that I've been beating the drum on besides this has been city councilor records are not public documents. I can't get their emails. I can't get their schedules. I don't know who they're meeting with. All of that in the States is very public. So, for instance, the mayor of Toronto was arrested for drunk driving and marijuana possession in Florida, I think in 1999.
And that, not this mayor.
This mayor.
Uh-huh.
And that came out during his election. But because it was the States, we just called up the, you know, the court office and they sent us the arrest sheet. And he was saying, no, I wasn't arrested for DUI. It was for not providing a breath sample. And then we were able to pull up the charge sheet along with his mugshot and say, no, it says right here, DUI. That sort of stuff can't happen in Canada. Those records are all sealed, and that's something that journalists come up against all the time. Mayor Rob Ford doesn't release a schedule every day. No one has any idea where he is. It's extremely frustrating.
Robin, you are an intrepid reporter who's been going after the mayor for a while now. I'm just wondering what you think of Gawker's willingness to give $200,000 to some drug dealers.
Obviously, as a journalist, you kind of form opinions on things. And on some things, you just kind of try to keep your opinions to yourself.
Okay, fair enough. Robin, thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
Robin Doolittle is a City Hall reporter with the Toronto Star. So Star Trek Into Darkness is number one at the box office right now, the sequel to the latest reboot by director J.J. Abrams of a cherished 47-year-old franchise.
Spock, nobody knows the rules better than you, but there has got to be an exception.
None. Such action violates the prime directive.
Spock, we're talking about your life!
The reboot was controversial when J.J. Abrams, who said outrageously that he never was a fan, released the first installment in 2009. Fans were offended in advance that he had the audacity to cast youngsters to impersonate Kirk and Spock, who could only be Shatner and Nimoy. But they were silenced by the bravura results. Here's The Onion's take.
And with us now to discuss the backlash is entertainment reporter Bree Lindsey.
Hi, Glenn.
Bree, is this Star Trek as riveting as the fans are complaining it is?
Glenn, early reviewers are calling it a delightful action-adventure movie and a surefire hit.
No wonder the fans feel betrayed here.
Apparently, there isn't even one scene set at a long table in which interstellar diplomacy is debated in endless detail.
Really?
What made it so fiendishly effective for long-time Trekkers, Trekkie is demeaning, was that its young Spock and Kirk were perfectly cast, and it offered comforting continuity and in-jokes, while at the same time introducing a change in the timeline of the voyages of the Starship Enterprise right at the beginning, so it wouldn't have to stay true to the past. Even more important, both films have stayed true to Star Trek's fundamental principles, as noted in this review on YouTube by Dead Drop SD 1972, who gave it a 10.
It asks you, what would you do? How far would you go? Your ethics tested to the limits to save your child, your crew, your best friend.
When I first reviewed the impact of the series on its 40th anniversary, I spent a lot of time on it. So here's a shorter version, because, as they say, Star Trek is here, it's dear, so get used to it.
Get a life, will you, people? For crying out loud, it's just a TV show.
When William Shatner said that on Saturday Night Live, though to be fair, he didn't write it, it stung.
I think a lot of fans feel like they are not respected. They're almost ashamed to admit they're fans of Star Trek unless they hear two or three references to Star Trek in the conversation.
Not Barbara Adams. So moved was she by the series' optimistic, pluralistic vision of the future that when serving on the jury in the Whitewater trial 10 years ago, she wore the uniform of a Star Trek officer. If it helps to make people think a little bit more about what those ideals are, then I'll keep wearing this uniform, she said, and then was promptly dismissed for talking to the press. Those ideals were codified by Gene Roddenberry, a former flack with the LAPD who cut his teeth writing Dragnet scripts on spec for Jack Webb. His Enterprise was staffed by a crack, multiracial crew, and though that crew was prohibited by the Prime Directive from interfering in developing societies, Captain James T. Kirk found some way to destroy evildoers wherever he went. Roddenberry allowed us to examine the convulsions of the 60s, racism, the Cold War, and hippies at a distance, mostly through aliens, since he had decreed that there would be no serious conflicts among the crew. But after three short seasons, the show died. And for 18 long years, the fans waited as their ranks swelled through reruns and conventions, writing their own episodes and lobbying the network. Henry Jenkins, director of the Comparative Media Studies program at MIT, says that much of that pressure came from an unexpected quarter.
I think if you go back and look at the original letter-writing campaign that kept the series on the air for that third season, which made it viable for a syndication package, the majority of the leaders of that campaign were women. And while the women were disappointed in the ways they were portrayed on Star Trek often, it kept alive this idea that women alongside men would be active participants in shaping the future.
So finally, after an animated series and four movies, a new live-action series was launched. And instead of boldly going where no man had gone before, the new captain was to
boldly go where no one has gone before.
We had three female cast members on Next Generation.
Executive producer Rick Berman.
One was Counselor Troy, one was the Doctor, and there was some discussion that here we had two women in caretaker roles, which seemed a little sexist. But Gene also created this character, Tasha Yar, who was the head of security on board the ship. She was a tough broad and probably the sexiest of the three.
Berman was hand-picked by Roddenberry to launch the second series, but he's been widely reviled by the fans for coming to the franchise as a newbie and for failing to fully commit to the founder's vision.
If I could sit and corral all the things that have been said over the years, you could put me just a little bit this side of Himmler. Did I see the original series as sacred? No. Did I do my very best to keep from contradicting anything that occurred in those episodes? Absolutely.
The Next Generation also depicted a crew on a voyage of exploration, captained by the resolutely rational Jean-Luc Picard. It lasted 7 years, bookended by a pair of episodes in which an omnipotent being called Q puts humanity on trial.
You will now answer to the charge of being a grievously savage race.
Grievously savage could mean anything. I will answer only specific charges.
Are you certain you want a full disclosure of human ugliness? Present the charges!
It's a squeaker, but guess who wins? In Star Trek, humanity always wins. The sole exception was series number 3, Deep Space Nine, mounted by Berman after Roddenberry's death. Set on a space station in a time of war, humans and aliens were forced to confront crime and corruption within the crew, and the humanity within all these species did not always win.
Will that be all, Commander?
I want you to know, I don't personally believe that you're responsible for this.
Really? Now, how can that be true? You don't know me. So don't tell me there isn't some doubt inside of you, some question about whether or not I murdered the man.
Some diehard fans grumbled about the dark nature of the show, but that series also lasted 7 years. The fourth series, Star Trek Voyager, was set on a ship flung to the outer reaches of the galaxy. Its mission was simply to return home, and it also marked a return to the original vision. Only this time, the glass ceiling was broken. Captain Catherine Janeway was at the helm, played by Kate Mulgrew.
I realized that what was at stake was their largest demographic, young men. How was I going to transcend the fact that they could be potentially watching their mother in the chair?
In fact, they watched her for 7 years, even though the bodacious Borg 7 of 9 was added to the crew to boost ratings. But even she represented more than just sex appeal, because in Star Trek, humanity was always the real final frontier, so the best-loved characters were not human. The half-Vulcan Spock in the first series, the android Data in the second, Odo, the shapeshifter, in the third, and 7 of 9 in the fourth, they showed what it meant to be human by reacting against it, or more often, groping toward it. Here's Data on a date.
This is all part of a program?
Yes, one which I have just created for romantic relationships. I have written a subroutine specifically for you. I have devoted a considerable share of my internal resources to its development.
Data... that's the nicest thing anybody's ever said to me.
Later, Data gets an emotion chip, but ultimately rejects it. Spock would approve. He never understood Kirk's infatuation with humanity.
But Captain, we both know that I am not human.
Spock, you want to know something? Everybody's human.
I find that remark insulting.
I love Spock. He's really awesome.
What's your name?
Emma.
How old are you?
15.
We found Emma at the Mohegan Sun Casino in Northern Connecticut checking out a display of Star Trek memorabilia soon to be auctioned by Christie's. Like thousands of others, Emma writes fan fiction, original stories based on the series, and she posts them on her blog, as do many of her friends.
Most of them write from the original series, Kirk and Spock. They either write Slash or just friendship.
What's Slash?
Slash is the gay romance, and it's very popular all over the web. And I write some of it, but I prefer the friendship.
She says the fans she's met online hated the last series, called Enterprise, set in a time before the original series, and they're very riled up about the new movie, another prequel, which recasts Kirk and Spock as students at Starfleet Academy.
And people say they can't do this to our franchise, and they call it their franchise. I know it's definitely not our franchise, but I think we have a big part in it, because without the fans, there would be no continuation. There would have been no The Next Generation or Deep Space Nine or Voyager.
Through the fans, Star Trek lives long and prospers in cyberspace, where they create and consume thousands of news stories and hundreds of videos, including new episodes. It's not what Trekkers solemnly regard as Star Trek canon. It's called fanon, a tapestry of new plots and backstories endlessly embroidered by fans. Tim Cavanaugh is the web editor of Reason Magazine.
We grew up really loving Star Trek in the purest possible way. We just loved it as kids. You get to high school, you get to college, suddenly you become this super ironist and you realize how campy it is and over the top. And every joke about Captain Kirk getting it on with green women or about crew members wearing red shirts and dying, they've all been made. To some degree, the show has outlived all of that stuff.
But that may not matter to some fans for whom the show may have actually outlived the show. Erstwhile Whitewater juror Barbara Adams.
I don't think fans should worry about there not being a Star Trek series on. If it's not a good Star Trek series, if it's not showing us what we want to see in Star Trek, we don't have to have it there.
At some point, for fans like Adams, Star Trek shapeshifted from a franchise to a kind of creed, perhaps because Roddenberry made it seem almost plausible, because it made use of some real science and referenced some real history. Or maybe it's because his founding vision was bound up in the belief that ultimately it's our shortcomings, our passion, our restlessness that will save us, that as much as Vulcan logic and detachment are venerated in the Trek world, it's somehow better to be human. Just kidding. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, PJ Vogt, Alex Goldman, Sarah Abdorfman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Ravenna Koenig, Alexandra Hall, and WNYC archivist Andy Lancet. And it was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Rick Kwan and Justin Garish. Katya Rogers is our senior producer, Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news, and our boss, bassist composer Ben Allison, wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.